So how big is a big church? When I went to college, I was there amongst a number of people from all over the country. And I remember very early someone asking me, and there was a group standing around, asking me about where I grew up, the congregation where I grew up. And I said, we had about 350 members. And I remember their eyes just getting really big at that. And for some reason, I felt compelled to try to justify that and say, but we've got other churches that are smaller in the county. And somebody said, well, how small? And I said, well, my grandmother goes to a church with 80. And their eyes got even bigger at that. The idea that you would consider 80 to be a small church in many places would consider to be very large. But yet I also think about visitors who we've had come here to Hughes Road. And occasionally I have heard more than once someone say, well, I like the feel here of a small church. It's a matter of perspective, isn't it? I would say, though, that as we look across the country and indeed across the world, that as we examine local congregations, the group here is a fairly large group. The group that we have here being much bigger than what we would find in many, many places. Interestingly, I've also heard some Christians almost speak with disdain about, quote, big churches. The idea being that all churches should be small, that you should not have a group this big, and I would wholeheartedly disagree with that. Because when you have a fairly large group of Christians assembling in a local work, there are opportunities there that are not there in smaller works. There are things that can be done that you could not do with fewer Christians. I would say that to have this many Christians in one location working together is indeed a blessing. However, wherever there is a blessing, there is a challenge. We know that Satan will not leave us alone. That when good things are happening, he's going to try even harder to make bad things happen. And so I think with any group, there must be a keen eye for that. Now let me just say at the outset, when we talk about challenges of a big church, someone might say, well, do you see the things that we're talking about here? These are not things that I have handpicked from the Hughes Road Church. However, over the years, I have had opportunity to be associated with congregations that were 200 and 300 members from time to time. And I have seen in all of those places the challenges that we're going to talk about this morning. And so it's always when someone comes up after a sermon and it says to me, did you preach that on my account? My standard answer is, well, if you needed it, yes. It is on your account. And I say the same thing today. As we consider this, let me tell you what I think is one of the bigger problems, one of the bigger challenges that's oftentimes faced by larger congregations. And that's the idea that very easily we can develop the idea that it's somebody else's job to do. In economics, there is a concept that's known as the law of diminishing returns. And what that simply means is that a business has got to watch out. Because if they have a limited space and a limited area, but they keep hiring more people, there will come a point when the work will actually start decreasing. When you'll have too many people trying to use too few tools and such, and that actually that will end up costing the business money. Now, I'm not here to say this morning that a church is a business and ought to be operated like that. In fact, in many ways, quite to the contrary. But a local congregation must make sure that that concept does not happen. That there are members who are added, that the numbers are growing, but yet the workload begins to decrease. And I believe in larger congregations, that's something that must be watched for. Why does that happen? Well, let me just give you some things that sometimes we're tempted to do in this regard. Sometimes the idea is that we just don't have a job that we want to do. And so because of that, we're going to pass the buck to someone else. Because this is a job that really does not meet my interest, there will be somebody else who will do that. I have no idea how big the church at Corinth was. I have a feeling it was a large church. When you read the letter, especially of 1 Corinthians, and the various conflicts and problems that are having, it seems that there were a lot of people there, and those people were having difficulties. We read this morning, Terry read to us from 1 Corinthians 12. And we're not going to reread that passage, but I would like to point out a couple of verses in that. If you will, look over to chapter 12, and let's go down near the end of this reading. And as we look here, I want you to note how the Apostle Paul words certain things. If you look down to verse 22 of chapter 12, note what's said. Here he says, on the contrary, the parts of the body... Now I want you to note this. The parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And on those parts of the body that we think less honorable, we bestow the greater honor. There was a problem in Corinth of thinking that there were certain jobs that you just didn't want to do. I think in the context here, it's dealing specifically with spiritual gifts. That there were some gifts that you wanted, there were some gifts that you didn't want. And the congregation had to learn a lesson. And what the apostle is showing here is, look, when you talk about the Lord's work, there are no little jobs. There are no jobs that are weaker than others. There are no jobs that are less important than others. And so if we ever get the mindset that, look, I don't want to do this because it's just not my thing. I don't want to do this because it's not so impressive. We need to understand that we are in violation of what Paul talked about to the Corinthians here. We've got to understand that there is work for everyone to do. Now let me tie in something very similar to that. We need to understand that in any work that we do, we are not doing it for notoriety. That was Corinth's problem, wasn't it? There were those who wanted spiritual gifts that would be standing out much more than others. There were those who wanted to make a name for themselves, to be in front of the congregation. Now the age of spiritual gifts is well gone. But the idea of doing things for notoriety, I believe, is still a temptation. And it's a temptation that goes very, very far back. We know that even Jesus dealt with that when He was here on the earth. You will look over to Matthew chapter 6. And I want you to note something that He brings out here concerning this idea of doing things for the notoriety that it will bring. As He warns those who are listening about the Pharisees, He says, beginning in verse 1, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. For then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Truly I say to you, they will have received their reward. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you." Jesus said there's a problem with their leaders. Their leaders were desiring to do spiritual work in order to be seen by men. They were making it a point that whenever good things were being done, they were making sure plenty of people were watching those things being done. And Jesus says, if you do your good works to receive the praise of men, you have gotten your reward. That's it. That's going to be all you get, will be the reward of hearing somebody say what a good job you've done. And so Jesus says, just empty yourself of that mindset. When you do your good works, he uses the hyperbole here, don't even let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Don't do it in such a way that you're even going to think, well, I'm a really good person for doing that. He says you do your good works for no other reason than because you have a duty to your Father in heaven and a duty to your fellow man. And he says if you'll do it that way, the one who sees everything will reward you openly for it. Now, is there anything wrong with us recognizing people who do good things? Is there anything wrong with us telling someone, well, I really appreciate what you've done? No. In fact, I think we'll even see this a little bit further in the lesson this morning. There's a time and a place for that. The question for me, though, is why am I doing it? Am I doing these things just to hear those good things from others? And if that's the case, then I need to make sure I'm changing. I think another way that we let somebody else do our job for us, we talked about passing the buck, but also the idea being that we think we're too busy. And so because of our busy schedule, there are plenty of others in a big church who can do it. And so I'm going to leave those things for those who are less busy than I am to do. If we ever get into that mindset, I believe we do quite well to examine a very familiar account in the Bible. Look with me over to Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10. Mary and Martha are two of the finest women that we find in Scripture. We know that they had a very close relationship with the Lord because of their spirituality, because they desired to be what He wanted them to be. And I imagine that if Martha had ever known that this was going to be recorded, she certainly would have rethought what she said. But it illustrates very much the concept that we can get into. As we look here in chapter 10, we'll actually pick up in verse 38. It says, "Now as they were on their way, Jesus entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed Him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to His teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving, and she went up to Him and said, 'Lord, do You not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me.' And the Lord answered her, 'Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things. But one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her.'" We can relate, can't we? You got a house full of folks. You realize these folks are going to be hungry, and so you're busy trying to get things ready and preparing. And Martha is in that mindset. She's wanting everything to be right. She's wanting her guests to be welcomed. And she sees Mary sitting over there who looks like she's not doing very much. And she says, "Lord, will You not command her? Will You not use Your authority to make her come and help me?" And Jesus rebukes in a very gentle way, but yet still a rebuke. And He says, "Martha, you're caught up in things you don't need to worry about. She's chosen the right thing." If ever I begin thinking, "Well, I'm busy, I work all the time, I've got lots of activities, and here's this person over here who doesn't have too much to do, let that person do the work that needs to be done," I may very well be falling into this concept. We need to understand that every one of us has been given 24 hours per day. That doesn't vary whether you have a lot to do or a little to do. Everyone is given 24 hours a day. Everyone is also given the free will to determine how those hours are going to be spent. Am I going to choose to spend my time in other things, in pursuits of the world, because I think, well, there's somebody who's not as busy as I am who can do those things? Or am I going to evaluate the work that I need to do in a congregation and make sure that I'm building in the time in my schedule to do the most important things? We have to beware of that attitude as well. And I guess the one probably that we have to beware of the most is this one. And it's just plain old laziness. We understand that no matter the size of the congregation, that's a problem. Laziness is something that God has warned about quite often. In fact, I'm always intrigued in the book of Proverbs how Solomon describes things. I want us to take just a minute to look over to Proverbs chapter 26. And as we look here, listen to how he describes the lazy man, the man who won't do anything. We look in verse 13, and Solomon again is using language to get our attention. He says, chapter 26, beginning in verse 13, "The sluggard says, 'There is a lion in the road. There is a lion in the streets. As the door turns on its hinges, so does a sluggard on his bed. The sluggard buries his hand in a dish. It wears him out to bring it back to his mouth. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly.'" Points being made. Here's a man who says there's a lion in the street, some big calamity, and his action is to turn the other way in the bed. And it says he puts his hand into the dish and it wearies him to bring it back up again. Laziness is a problem that God warns us about. And it's a problem that we have to beware of as we're members of a congregation. The problem that we oftentimes face in big churches is that we can be lazy because someone else will do it. You've got 200, 250, 300 people in a congregation, and I say, well, I'm just not going to do that. Somebody else will. Somebody else will take care of it. However, the question I've got to ask myself is, though the work has been done, am I right with God for putting that off on someone else? And it's almost like the psychological idea of enabling. Someone's enabling me to be lazy because they're doing what I need to be doing. So if I find myself putting off work just simply because I don't want to do it, I'm not trying to deceive myself by saying I'm too busy, I'm not doing it because it doesn't get any notoriety, I'm just not doing it because I'm lazy. I need to very much consider that and ask myself, am I doing the work that I need to be doing? So what do we realize? No matter what the size of a congregation is, there's plenty of work for every member. The bigger a congregation gets, the bigger the workload. Well, what about each of us? As we think about our relationship to this congregation, to one another in our work for the Lord, am I doing everything I can? Let me just offer a couple of suggestions here. The elders sometime back divided the congregation up into various work groups, and they said, what we want you to do is to make sure that things are done that might fall between the cracks. Make sure that things aren't being overlooked. And if I'm not mistaken, every person in the congregation was put into one of these. Well, how active are you in that? Certainly that shouldn't be the extent of what we do, but nonetheless, it's a very good starting point. Here is a way where the congregation is making sure that though there are a number of members, everyone is getting what's needed. You're looking out for the needs of one another. You're encouraging those who we support in the work of the gospel. Writing letters, sending cards, making phone calls, all of these things, how active are we in that? That's a good starting point for us. If I say, well, there are others in there who will do that. There's others who can take care of those needs better than I can. Where am I fitting in those points that we just made? Am I too busy? Is there not enough notoriety? Is it just because of laziness? Where am I fitting in that? I need to make sure that I'm not neglecting what I'm called on to do. Are you encouraging those who are wavering in the faith? When you get to a congregation of this size, it's very similar to a string of those blinking Christmas lights. If you can just kind of imagine spirituality in that regard, you've got some that are kind of weakening and some that are kind of strengthening. What we've got to make sure is that none of them go out. We've got to make sure that if there are those who are weak in the faith, that we, if we are strong, are going and we're helping to bring them back. That's work that I need to do. And in a congregation this size, I can almost guarantee you there is always that work to do. All of us are having times of spiritual difficulty. If I'm in need, then I need someone to come and help me with that. And if I'm strong, I need to be sharing that strength with others. Am I busy encouraging those who are faithful to keep up the good work, to encourage them in the work that they're doing, whether that be in this group, whether it be men with whom we share fellowship in supporting the gospel? Am I making sure that I'm encouraging those who are faithful? None of us need to be sitting on the sidelines. There is not a member of this congregation who does not have something that can be offered to this work. It may not be the biggest thing in the eyes of men. It may not be something that's going to draw a lot of attention, but there are things that I need to be doing. So as we consider the work of a local congregation, let's make sure we're meeting the challenge not to put that off on someone else, but to do the work that I, as a member of this congregation, am called on to do. Now, let's kind of change gears a little bit with this. We've been talking about the work that we can do. But what about the relationships that we have with one another? The term clique is a term that is oftentimes connected with high school. High schoolers have a big problem with cliques. And a lot of times, the bigger the high school, the bigger the problem that you have with this. You start dividing off into various groups, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, as we'll talk about later. But we also need to understand that that doesn't necessarily go away when we become adults. In fact, going back to the church at Corinth, there was cliquiness there, wasn't there? And it was of the very worst kind. Let's look back to the book of 1 Corinthians and look at chapter 1. Familiar reading to us here as we think about the problems that they had. As we go to verse 11, the apostle just right off the bat is going to deal with this problem. He says, verse 11, "For it has been reported to me by Chloe's people, and there is quarreling among you, my brothers. What I mean is that each of you says, 'I am of Paul,' or 'I follow Apollos,' or 'I follow Cephas,' or 'I follow Christ.' Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized into the name of Paul? I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that no one may say that you were baptized in my name." Why do I say that this was cliques of the worst sense? It was spiritual cliques. And I'm not sure I understand fully what all was involved in this. What it appears is that they may have divided up based on who converted them, who brought them to the Lord. Or it may be that they kind of felt like this person was the greatest, and there may have even been a clique that said, "Well, we saw Christ. We saw Him and you didn't while He was here on earth." Whatever the case, Paul says that is just absolutely wrong. You are not to be dividing up. You're not to be dividing into these spiritual cliques where nothing is being done to encourage those outside of that group. Well, as we think about that, does that mean that we can't have close friends? Does that mean that it's a condemnation that if we have a close-knit group that we're comfortable with, that that's wrong? No. If you'll notice in the work of Jesus, there were a lot of times where He carried three of the apostles with Him. He never explained why. I don't know if these were men with whom He shared more of a close bond. These were men who had similar... He doesn't share that. But we understand that there were occasions when Jesus needed them, wanted them might be the better term, associated with that work where there were others who weren't involved in that particular action. This is not a condemnation to say that we can't have a close set of friends. What it is a condemnation of saying we cannot be exclusive. That I am going to have my own group, and I really don't care what happens outside of that group. We have to be very careful of that in lots of ways. We have to be very careful of that in even our social dealings. But we have to be extremely careful of that when it comes to our work together as a local church. So as we consider that, and again, I don't know that this is something that I see as a big problem here, but wherever you have that larger group, there's always that potential. So how do we avoid that from happening? How do we develop kind of a clique prevention, if you will? Well, first of all, we've got to understand what the Lord has said concerning our attitude toward all of our brethren. Let's look over to 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4. And as we look here, notice what the Lord says, or through John here, concerning our attitude toward brethren. 1 John chapter 4, looking down to verse 7. He says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God, and whoever loves has been born of God and knows God. Anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love. In this, the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent His only Son into the world so that we might live through Him. In this is love, not that we have loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God. If we love one another, God abides in us and His love is perfected in us." Book of 1 John concentrates on the theme of loving each other, being there for each other. And if as a part of a large group, I want to make sure that I'm not being exclusive, that I'm not developing into kind of a clique that keeps everybody else on the outside, I need to make sure this is in my life. That I have the appropriate relationship with everyone of the congregation. Also, as we consider this, we need to think about our hospitality. First of all, are we showing it? And if we are, to whom are we showing it? As you think about who you have invited into your home this past year, we're getting close to the end of the year, so just think back. Who have you had in? Has this been a very wide sampling of people from the congregation? Have you made it a point to invite people in who you don't know real well, who you want to know better, or people who you know are going through some kind of crisis or weakness and you're trying to do that? Or has it been simply a group with whom you enjoy visiting? That's a good test for us to see where we stand. It's a good test for us to look and to see if we are opening our homes, if we are carrying out this command that God has told us so that we can make sure that we're growing close to everyone here. I would suggest to us as well that we examine who we talk to here at assemblies. As we think about our work together, our coming together, three times a week, who is it that we're talking to? We include myself in this number, we have kind of a problem no matter where we're a member, aren't we? We like our bench, don't we? You know, I'm not an evolutionist, but if I were, I would not think we were descended from monkeys. I would think we were descended from homing pigeons, you know, because you know, we just circle and we want to stay in that same place. I remember a couple of years ago, Pam and I were on a class trip with a group, and we were on the road, and we stopped at a very large church for morning assembly. The auditorium was probably about double this size, and we got there fairly early and sat down, nobody around us. I bet it wasn't 5 minutes before there was a man standing looking at us, not saying anything, looking at us. And I said, "Did we get your seat?" "Yes." "Would you like for us to move?" "That would be good." And so we got up and we moved. We have that problem, don't we? Well, that's okay. That's okay. We've got our favorite bench. However, here's the problem. Those around us have their favorite spot too. And if we're not careful, that becomes the circle to whom we're speaking. Sunday night, Wednesday night. And we're not making the point to go to others. Let me tell you, that's how cliques begin. We think about something as trivial and as simple as that. If we're not careful, what we are doing is we are excluding others from our circle. And we've got to be careful about that. I would also suggest to us that we not be age exclusive. There are times when we get older, we enjoy the company of older people who can share our experiences. We're younger, we enjoy the company of younger people who share our experiences. And occasionally there are times where these groups never meet ways. You know, they never are in the same circle, and that is a real shame. Because for younger Christians, there is a very great need for older Christians to share in that wisdom. And for older Christians, there is a very great need for younger Christians to share in that energy. We don't need to be exclusive in that. And again, I encourage us, whatever age group we're in, that we are not viewing our clique, our group, as only those in that age range. All of these things, if we'll just be careful, we can prevent ourselves from falling into those difficulties. Well, let me ask one other thing of you as we think about this, and also to consider this point, the idea of just simply checking out. Anonymity is a danger in big churches because it's very easy to get in and get out without being noticed. It's very easy to come in a few minutes late and to leave a minute or two early and to never have any actions, any kind of relationship with anybody in the group. Sometimes people will be asked about that. And a lot of times the answer that will be given is, well, that church is just unfriendly. That church, even if I stayed around, they're not even going to talk to me. Well, let me say a couple of things about that. As we consider more words from the wise man, Proverbs chapter 18, first part of verse 24 says, "A man who has friends must himself be friendly." We have a counselor there at the school. He's been there a number of years. And so he has pretty much seen it all. And I've always been impressed with the statement that he makes, because this is one of the things that is oftentimes brought to him. "I just don't have any friends here. I can't be accepted." A lot of times he'll go to a door to make this illustration if he can. He'll say a door can open one of two ways. It can be either be opened to you, or it can be opened by you. And the point that he's making is if you want to have friends, sometimes you've got to make the effort. You've got to try. Let me tell you, on a much more serious note, we've got to do that as Christians. If we ever feel like, well, this group just isn't friendly, well, there's nobody here who is showing me any concern, maybe it starts with you. Maybe it begins with you. And I tell you, sometimes that takes us way out of our comfort zone. Sometimes we're kind of shy and we want others to make the first move. But it may be that I have to do that. Because if I kind of check out and I come to assemblies just to kind of soothe my conscience and say, well, okay, I've done something and therefore I've satisfied God, we're placing ourselves in a very, very dangerous situation. Because what we are not receiving is the needed edification from our brethren. That's not our primary purpose for being here at all. Our primary purpose is to worship God. But one of the secondary purposes of being here is the fact that we draw on the strength of one another. I think that's what the Apostle Paul was saying when he wrote to the Thessalonians. They were having some difficulty understanding things. And he said in chapter 5 and verse 11, "Therefore encourage one another and build one another up, just as you are doing." The Thessalonians needed to do that. The Christians at Hughes Road need to do that. We need to be building one another up. We need to be encouraging one another. But if I'm a person who says, well, I'm going to come in just in time for the worship assembly and I'm going to leave before it's over, I'm not going to get that. And it will become very telling in my life. I will not have the strength that I could have otherwise. And it may also be that you have the edification someone else needs. Because you are not edifying others, there may be those in the congregation who are not receiving that strength that they need to receive. So I encourage any of us who feel that way that we get over that feeling. That we make sure that we're not just trying to rush in, rush out, not be a real active part of the congregation, but to make a conscious effort to make sure that we're doing our part to build up and to be built up. Because you see, if we're all doing our work and we're all loving one another and we're edifying and encouraging one another, as long as we stay faithful to the plan of God, we will be doing the work that a local congregation is called on to do. And as we bring these thoughts to a close, let me just remind you of what the Lord says, Luke chapter 12, verse 48. He says, "Everyone to whom much was given, of him much will be required. And from him to whom they entrusted much, they will demand the more." I think the Lord would say that to a large congregation. There's been a lot entrusted to you. There's been a lot given to you. How are you using that? Are you working as I expect you to work? And I hope that when each of us can answer yes to that question, we as a congregation then will be able to answer yes to that question. That we are doing the work of the Lord, each of us just as hard as we can, and we are looking out for the needs of others. And when we do that, the Lord will tell us that what has been expected has been fulfilled.